This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Marijuana, the topic, is a hot-button issue in state governments, including here in Indiana. While some states have found ways to reform laws that have been found to disproportionately affect communities of color, other states are still in limbo, trying to find the right approach. Should the drug be legalized and controlled by state government, or should it become commercialized and for sale over-the-counter, or should it still be banned? There are many different avenues that have been looked at and proposed. While all that continues to be debated, there have been those who've taken matters into their own hands. Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears announced in September of 2019 that his office would stop prosecuting people with less than an ounce of marijuana, but the drug still remains illegal. With us now to talk more about all of this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get started here and sort of talk a little bit broadly. You've been covering the topic of marijuana in Indiana for some time. Can you get us up to speed here with what exactly is going on right now in the State House and just the state as a whole?
Yeah, so in the State House, there's not a whole lot going on. Marijuana legislation very rarely makes it past the first step in becoming law, which is getting out of the committee it's assigned to after first reading. The notable exception is CBD oil or cannabidiol oil that was legalized in 2017 for epilepsy only and a couple of other qualifying health conditions. And then that use was expanded in 2018, where you can now buy it at Whole Foods or Fresh Time. But that legislation also include packaging restrictions and a number of other regulations. Democrats have been championing marijuana legalization, medical use, and decriminalization for more than a decade. Recently, a few Republicans have hopped on board. And in a broad generalization, religious conservative groups, the Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Council, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and most recently, the Indiana Commission to Combat Drug Abuse, have all taken firm stances against any form of legalization or decriminalization.
I want to take a step back. You mentioned about the cannabis types of oils and things that at first were only approved for epilepsy, and now it's just a more general availability. Is this something that anybody could purchase, or do you have to show some kind of ID?
I think you have to be older than 18 or maybe 21 in order to purchase. But yeah, you can pick it up at a gas station or Whole Foods at this point.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a little bit of a shift, it sounds like. It went from being very, very restrictive to a few years later kind of opening up a little bit more.
Yeah, ever so slightly. the CBD oil had a few more champions behind it, especially from the supermajority Republicans. And so you're starting to see a little bit more support for the legalization of marijuana in any form as well. So Representative Jim Lucas, who represents Seymour, Indiana, has been a vocal supporter over the last few years and has offered marijuana legislation pretty consistently starting in 2018. We've also seen greater pushes from veterans groups. The American Legion, AmVets, have also made recent pushes for decriminalizing medical marijuana, arguing in favor of the benefits it may have for treating anxiety, depression, and PTSD. What's really fascinating and kind of the biggest step that the legislature has made was 2018 was the first year the General Assembly allowed a summer study committee on the legalization of medical cannabis at all. And it received hours of testimony, both for and against.
So it sounds like there's some shifts happening. I know you mentioned some groups are firmly coming out against this. Other groups are coming in support of this. Is it a certain type of usage that is getting more favorable support? You mentioned medical usage for, I guess, veterans and folks that say that there's a benefit to it. Is that sort of where it's headed in that sense versus like recreational?
Yeah, I mean, for the groups who are in favor of, you know, any form of legalization, they kind of vary wildly. There are a lot of folks, you know, who focus on decriminalization because of the disproportionate impact it has on communities of color. And then you kind of range rather wildly beyond that. But it seems to kind of I don't think that there's much of a path forward for legalization of any form without federal approval. A lot of the folks who are against, who argue against any sort of decriminalization or legalization of cannabis, argue that because the FDA cannot prove any of the claims on medical marijuana because you don't have marijuana testing in the United States or research in the United States that much, you end up kind of coming to a stalemate where, so for example, in 2018, the Drug Commission basically said, hey, you know what, until the FDA gives any sort of approval for medical marijuana, the conversation is over. And that seems to be the position of a lot of Republicans and certainly the position of Governor Eric Holcomb as well.
That's interesting. I think when you think in context of the FDA and how certain things get pushed through quickly, you would think they could do some medical marijuana testing if they pushed the COVID vaccine through an emergency order. So that's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Have you seen any demonstrations for or against legalizing marijuana in Indiana? Is this a topic that people feel really passionately about?
Yes, definitely for the folks who are in favor of marijuana, they are very passionate. I am the unofficial protest reporter for our statewide team, and that is definitely how they have pushed, especially because you don't see the General Assembly having a lot of testimony. These bills typically don't make it out of committee, and so you don't have a public avenue for testimony in favor. So you see a lot more protest because of that. The most recent I covered was actually the beginning of 2020, right before COVID hit Indiana. Several groups gathered together to protest in favor of full legalization. Bill Levin, the grand poobah of the First Church of Cannabis, was in attendance. And the crowd actually passed around joints and other cannabis products because of what you mentioned at the top with Ryan Mears, Marion County prosecutor, saying that he wouldn't prosecute anybody for possession of more than or less than an ounce.
So how does Indiana compare to neighboring states like Illinois and Michigan when it comes to all of this?
Yeah, we are definitely the most strict. Of course, Michigan legalized marijuana for recreational use in November 2018, and it became the first Midwest state to do so. Illinois followed suit in May 2019. Interestingly enough, Ohio legalized medical cannabis in 2016. Multiple cities and counties have decriminalized possession charges. And fun fact, in 1975, Ohio, air quotes, decriminalized possession for fewer than 100 grams to a minor misdemeanor, though according to an ACLU report from 2013, black Ohioans are more than four times likely to be arrested for possession. And Kentucky is the most similar to Indiana, but their attempts to legalize medical cannabis have gotten much farther. Their legalization attempts made it to the full House in 2020 and are promised to be moving their way through the state house there in 2021.
If you have any questions or comments about legalizing marijuana in Indiana, let us know on Facebook or Twitter. We're at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Now, Lauren, it's important to note, as you mentioned earlier, that there's laws that criminalize cannabis and they heavily impact communities of color at a disproportionate rate. Have you heard any lawmakers address this issue at all in the legislation they're pushing?
Yeah, decriminalization legislation has been offered up basically every year. Again, this is something that's been championed mostly by Democrats. Senate Minority Leader Greg Taylor, who represents Indianapolis, offered legislation this year to create a defense for possession of marijuana paraphernalia for folks who have legal cards in other states. Interestingly, one of the six marijuana-specific bills that were offered this year by Representative Heath Van Natter, a Republican from Kokomo, authored a decriminalization measure for possession of less than 2 ounces, but none of those bills got hearings in committees.
Well, when you speak about the ounces and the measurements of you know, what constitutes breaking the law and what is something that will get a pass, we go back to Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears, who said he's not going to prosecute things that are less than, I believe, I want to say a gram. I don't know anything
ounce.
About marijuana. An ounce. Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't really know much about this personally. So, yeah, I don't know how people measure this or weigh it or what they do. But was that a good idea? Were there tangible results out of that that people can draw and say, like, wow, look at this. It helped law enforcement focus on really big crimes versus somebody having, you know, a little bit of something in their pocket?
Yeah, that's it. So far, I think that we don't have enough data to draw any conclusions from Marion County. Ryan Mears, the week that he was selected as the replacement for former prosecutor Terry Curry, who stepped down to focus on cancer treatments, was the announcement of possession of less than 1 ounce would no longer be prosecuted. So that was late 2019. That being said, there has been a response to it and kind of a tangible blowback from Indianapolis Republicans in the State House. Bills have been filed the last 2 years targeting Mears' decision. Specifically, this year's version narrowly passed the Senate and has yet to be heard in committee, though deadlines are fast approaching. Those kind of responses have definitely been at the forefront of that particular decision from Mears.
Well, I think it's important for us to also try to understand what it is that folks who are opposed to this feel and think. Have you heard anything from anyone who's just not about legalizing this and maybe they're thinking it's not a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, the veterans groups are the most interesting to me, more fun fact and quirk than anything else. But a lot of their arguments really focus around, you know, PTSD, anxiety, depression. But there's also a really fascinating part of the push for marijuana legalization that stems specifically from Indiana's opioid epidemic. Those veterans groups have offered support, pointing to opioid addictions in veterans and other folks who, you know, are kind of the result of Indiana's opioid epidemic. And that's a really interesting and seems to be a really compelling argument for a lot of Republicans across the state.
Well, thank you so much, Lauren. Lauren Chapman is the digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Up next, we'll hear from some lawmakers on why they support a new bill headed to the governor's desk that would give a driver found to have THC in their blood a pass when it comes to being charged with an OWI. The details on what that entails coming up. I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. Drivers involved in a car crash who are found to have THC in their system will soon have a law that works in their defense. THC is the psychoactive component in marijuana. And SB 201, which passed the General Assembly and is headed to the governor's desk, would give the driver found to have THC in their blood a pass as long as they weren't responsible for the crash. Basically, they wouldn't be charged with an OWI or operating while intoxicated. It sounds almost like state government is inching towards some reforms, but still hesitant to tackle the issue head on. With us now to talk more about laws and how these kinds of bills get written up in the first place, we have with us Indiana State Senator Karen Talion and Indiana State Senator Mike Bohacek. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. I'd like to start with you, Senator Bohacek. You're one of the authors of SB 201, which doesn't charge a driver with an OWI as long as they're not responsible for the crash. How did this bill come about, and why is it so specific?
So what we did is we started this, Senator Young and myself started working on this about 3 years ago, and we brought the bill forward last year via an amendment. It did fail. We did it as a standalone bill this year, and it passed. You know, the problem is that especially like in I live in Northwest Indiana, but a lot of our bordering states have some version of legalized marijuana, either medicinal, recreational, or both. So the concern is that in Indiana, if you have 1 nanogram of active metabolite of THC, you know, THC is fat soluble, so it's going to take for a typical person about 10 days to get the active metabolite out. This isn't the waste product you would see in your urine. This is the active in your blood. So because of that, you are determined to be intoxicated by for the purposes of Indiana law. So if you're not at fault, for instance, you're sitting at a stop sign, somebody rear-ends you and breaks their wrist or their arm, and that's called serious bodily injury, you could potentially be blood tested. And if you have one nanogram, which means you could have, you know, uptook the product, you know, 10 days ago, you're going to be charged with a 5 felony. More tragically, if the person passes away, still not your fault, you know, you're looking at a level 4 felony. And it just does not seem proportional. And it needed to get resolved. We've got a long way to go on some other pieces of some of our marijuana laws, but I think this is a good first step.
Was this based on any sort of like a personal situation anyone had or knew of? Maybe they heard a story that compelled this bill to get written up?
I don't think so. I did not have firsthand experience other than the fact that it just seemed like it was wrong, and it wasn't proportional, and it was over punitive. I mean, you know, if we're going to have this drug legal around us, to have a situation where somebody could be put in jail for an act that wasn't of their own fault and they're not intoxicated because they've got to prove impairment. And if you're not impaired, then why should you be charged with it? So there was no specific rationale behind it with a constituent at all. So.
Yeah, I guess because it just sounds so specific. I'm like, someone had to have really thought this out. Like, if this happens and then that happens, this could happen. So it just sounded very specific. Senator Talian, you're also an author on this bill and the only Democrat. Given the history of the reforms you've pushed for, this seems small potatoes. So why did you feel the need to support it?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I think in the modern era, I probably started this discussion, I know, going back to at least 2009. Mitch Daniels was still in office when I started talking about something needs to be done to reform marijuana laws, because the sentences and the consequences were just ridiculous, frankly. As I heard you say earlier, yeah, in Ohio, they decriminalized marijuana in 1975. So did a bunch of other states. So you were asking about why I am on this bill. Well, I am the ranking minority member on that committee. So I would naturally, you know, get on a bill like this anyway. But marijuana has been in my bailiwick for, like I said, more than a decade. And so, of course, I would get on this bill. I also have been talking about this with Mike Young for a couple of years. We all knew that we had to fix this. And the situation that you described is not unusual. As an attorney, I've had cases like this. I had a case, for example, where there was a truck driver who was involved in a big accident. It was not in any way his fault, but he had that trace amount of marijuana in his system, and he was the guy that everybody wanted to blame. You must have done something wrong, because as Mike said, right now, it's a per se violation. If you have this metabolite in your body, you are automatically and guilty of at least a misdemeanor.
So the laws, you know, definitely seem to come down heavy on what to some might seem that it isn't as big of a deal. Senator Bohacek, are you in favor of seeing marijuana legalized?
Yeah. I've always been a proponent of medicinal legalization. You know, I'm still a little hesitant with recreational legalization, and it doesn't mean, you know, not decriminalizing it for recreational purposes. I think the tricky part's got to be, because I live right on the Michigan border, so, and both Senator Talian and I, our districts connect pretty much, so we're close to Chicago as well. I guess once we can get an idea of what actually is intoxicated for purposes of THC, which we don't really have. Every state seems to have a different standard. And we don't really have a rapid test like we do with a breathalyzer. Once we can get to that place, then I'm on board. I'm not thrilled about one more intoxicant, rolling around the system. But once we can determine, at least for driving purposes, what is intoxicated and what isn't, then I think that's something that we're ready. Then, in my opinion, I'd be ready to move forward with it. But on the medicinal side, I've been all in all along. So.
And would you say for you and Senator Talian, living on these borders and seeing, folks coming from other states, gives you a different perspective than maybe some of your counterparts who are away from that and may not see it?
I'll let Karen, I'll defer to Senator.
I've talked to people, and it's not just Mike and I close to Chicago. Mike's right outside of Michigan. People are telling us that all up and down all the borders of the state, all up and down the east side, all up and down the west side, they all see it. Their people are going across the state line to do whatever they need to do. Or they drive to another, they'll take a road trip to somewhere and come back with this. This is for decades the most scoffed law in the entire United States, and everybody knows that.
Well, what inspired you, Senator Talian, to take on this issue? Is there something that, some encounter with someone, a client or something, that just really made you take this on?
I can tell you that. I like to tell the story because I remember, I'm an attorney. I sat in court one morning. I was like 2 minutes late, so it meant I had to go to the end of the line, right? So I'm sitting there, and I watched one after another young people come in, plead guilty to possession of marijuana case. There must have been 20 of them, all in a row. And I thought, what a colossal waste of time, energy, money, resources, because people, they've had to be arrested. They had police involvement. They had probation involvement. They had drug, programs that they had to go to, and all for something that, in my view, when I'm a child of the 60s and 70s. I consider marijuana to be basically the same par as alcohol. And we have alcohol, we tolerate alcohol, we know that it has evils or whatever, but, the idea that all these people were jeopardizing their future and their criminal record just seemed ridiculous. So even back in 2010, I got a study committee, actually. Mine was the first study committee ever where we talked about we at least needed to pull down the penalties from felony to a misdemeanor. And I've been working on getting rid of that ever since so that it would at least be decriminalized. You wouldn't get a criminal record. That was my biggest push. And over the last decade, of course, you've seen how many other states have either legalized medical or legalized everything. And it's just time. Mm-hmm. We're past time.
Well, as someone who's sort of pioneered this forefront to legalize marijuana, was there any sort of pushback or backlash that you faced, doing this at such a would have seemed an early time? Now, yes, other states are starting to make changes, but for you to come out before anyone, I'm sure it had to be pretty difficult.
People warned me, be careful. Be careful, you're going to hurt your political career. And you know what? It turned out to be the most popular thing I ever did. No matter what else I've done in the State House, I am known as, the marijuana senator and am backed all over the state for that.
So that's your official title now.
Well, there are other titles, but I won't go into that right now.
Yeah, I guess we got to keep this clean. Senator Bohacek, when we were talking a little bit earlier about folks crossing state lines or trying to go, into Illinois or Michigan to get recreational or medical marijuana. How does that impact Indiana? And are you seeing the need for, I don't know, looser laws aside from this SB 201?
I guess looser in what respect? Looser in possession? Looser in, I mean,
maybe possession or punishment for being found to have marijuana on them.
You know, I mean, my own personal opinions, I think it should be decriminalized up to a certain point. I mean, when we talk about incarcerating people because of, you know, marijuana possession, it's 3 ounces before you even reach to a point of a felony in the state of Indiana. That's quite a bit of marijuana. But, you know, I think, at least in my opinion, that if we're going to see any real substantial movement in the state of Indiana, it's going to need to be led by the feds. Just from my own discussions, I know this bill that we worked on that we're talking about took a couple of years to get across. We battled with CBD oil for several years. I just think that we're going to be in a situation that once the feds legalize it, it's going to be a lot easier. But I just think that in the state of Indiana right now, we have a lot of folks that just don't feel real comfortable with it. So I don't think you're going to see a lot more loosening.
Have you had conversations with your counterparts in other states on some of their successes or failures or ways to change things in Indiana from their experience?
You know, I've just by where my district's at, and I'm on a I'm on a multi-state task force for Lake Michigan issues. And I talked to my senators from Michigan, and, you know, even the most conservative feel pretty comfortable with it, but with what's happening in Michigan. But I just don't know where we're at in Indiana yet. And but my cross-border folks feel pretty good about it. And it's not about, everybody talks about how much, you know, what the tax implications are and how much revenue you can generate. I don't see it as how much revenue you can generate. I just see it as not forcing somebody into criminality just for using what is, in my opinion, a benign substance. Like Senator Tyen said, you know, she feels it's like more like alcohol. I don't necessarily disagree. It certainly is a lot more convenient to use than alcohol when you're, you know, in public or when you're driving, which probably adds a different perspective to it. But I just think that, unfortunately, we're just going to have to wait for the feds in the state of Indiana to legalize it.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Tallien, how hard is it to... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that I'm waiting for the feds to legalize it so much as take it off Schedule 1. Because right now, it's on the same schedule of drugs as opium. And I believe that it's going to happen in the next probably 12 to 18 months that the feds will take it off Schedule 1, because we have so many other states that have opened up this market, whether medical or recreational, and there are banking implications. There are all kinds of other reasons why the rest of these states, now a majority of the delegates in the House, are from states that need to have this taken off Schedule 1. I think that's going to happen. I think that will end the excuse for some of the people in Indiana who say, oh, I'm not doing anything till the feds delist it. But, you know, we still are doing, and this is from the prosecutor's own website, we're still doing between 23 and 25,000 arrests each year for simple possession. And a lot of those cases are not going to jail anymore. At least we're past that. But they're on pretrial diversion. So we're still letting people off. But now the counties, the prosecutors, whoever, are collecting the fees. It's used as a fundraiser. And there's a lot of pushback to getting rid of that.
So what are the next steps now after SB 201 gets signed? Any new things that you're pushing for, Senator Tallien and Senator Bahacik?
Well, right now I'm working on It's a House Bill 1202. It's to allow some relief for folks that were convicted of drug crimes back before we did sentencing. I don't know what that's
called. Sentencing reform. Yeah.
Reform. There you go. Thanks, Senator. So we did that back in 2015, I believe. That was Senate. That was House Bill 1206. So we're trying to get that straightened out. So we have folks, unfortunately, that are sitting in prison right now on sentences that are 3, 4, 5 times what they would be under current sentencing guidelines. So we're moving that through. We have the language in place, and that's going to be before the Senate committee on Tuesday. So we feel really good we're going in the right direction.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Senators Karen Talian and Mike Bohacek. Coming up, it's National Arab American Heritage Month. If this is the first time you've heard of it, you're not alone. When we come back, we'll talk to a professor who says Arab Americans have a rich history in Indiana dating back to the late 1800s. If you have a question or comment, leave us a message on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or send us a digital voice message through our app, All in Vox Pop. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Arab Americans have a rich history in the United States, and when most people tend to think of large Arab communities, their mind tends to go to locations outside of Indiana. April is National Arab American Heritage Month, and perhaps it's a good time to bust some myths and learn a little bit more about the early immigrants who called this state home. With us now is Professor Edward Curtis, the Plater Chair at IUPUI, who's been working on a documentary about the history of Arab Americans in Indiana. Thank you so much for joining us, Edward. So I'd like to start and say, you know, I was definitely surprised to learn about early Arab Americans that came to Indiana. And this isn't honestly the first state that would come to mind when thinking about early Arab immigrants. Can you give us a little history on when Arabs first settled in the area? And I think you need to have your mic on, or maybe just unplug your headphones so we can hear you. Are you there? For some reason, we're not getting any sound. I don't know. Let's try it again. Okay, still we're not able to get you in. Let me take a quick break, and we will resolve this issue. So just sit back and enjoy some music for a second here. And you're listening to All In. With us right now is Professor Edward Curtis to talk about the history of Arab Americans in Indianapolis. So, Edward, what compelled you to look into the history of Arabs settling in Indiana?
Well, I grew up an Arab American in southern Illinois. And when I moved here in 2005, I had no idea that there was such a long history of Arab Americans. I knew that there were Arab Americans all across the Midwest who came here in the late 1800s for economic opportunity. But I just, nothing had been published on it. So I started to dig in looking in the immigration of Arab Americans throughout the Midwest, and I came across a lot of stories. And this is just not part of Indiana history in a way that it needs to be. So I decided I would partner with Arab American communities in Indianapolis and across the state and try to unearth that history.
And what did you find? Was there anything super surprising?
I mean, the super surprising was the presence. The Arab Americans were not unusual. They were all over Indiana. They were in Michigan City and Fort Wayne and Terre Haute and Indianapolis. That they were making incredible economic contributions. They were powering the economy of the state before World War I as workers, building railroad cars up in at the Haskell Barker factory in Michigan City. And they were and the other thing that really surprised me was that the first Arabic-speaking neighborhood here in Indianapolis is currently buried underneath Lucas Oil Stadium. That was the heart of Arab Indianapolis in 1900.
And what made them choose these Arab immigrants? What made them choose Indiana over any other state?
Yeah, so sometimes people think that all the immigrants who came to the United States after the Civil War came to the East Coast. But actually, it was the Midwest that was the economic powerhouse of the country at the time. Lands were being taken away from Native Americans, and they were turned into farmland. And that farmland was being offered through the Homestead Act for settlers, for settlement. And all of the new wheat and corn and soybeans fueled an incredible economic expansion across the region, including in Indiana. And so really, if you were looking for jobs in 1880, 1890, 1900, or free land, for many immigrants, the Midwest was the place to come. And a lot of Arabic speakers came in 1893 to the Chicago World's Fair. They had heard about it. It was being written about in Arabic. And so really, you know, the Midwest was already global. It was part of globalization by the late 1800s. And that's why they came here.
Mm-hmm. And were there any personal discoveries that you made? Things that popped out and you were like, wow, this really, gives me a connection more to my American roots and also my Arab American culture.
Absolutely. You know, I remember growing up, a brown-skinned boy in southern Illinois, people would politely ask me about my nationality, even though I clearly had a southern Illinois sort of hickish accent. And, I think there was – I got the message at times that there was some kind of tension between being Arab and being American. And what I discovered – my grandmother gave me a different view of that, by the way. She was both 100% American and 100% Arab. And that's how I was brought up. And what I found in that first generation of Arabic-speaking people in Indianapolis, they were the same way. They did not give up their Arab culture, their religion. They were in Indianapolis, they were mostly Christian. Up in Michigan City, there were a large number of Muslims. But they established their religious congregations, a mosque and churches, and they taught their kids Arabic, and they continued to cook Arabic food, and they bought Arabic records like crazy. They loved to listen to Arabic music produced and recorded here in the United States. And so they also served in World War One. They were members of the Shriners. They joined the YWCA, the YMCA. They were participating in the heart of Indianapolis. So they thought they could do both. It wasn't a conflict. They thought actually that they complemented, Arab and American identities complemented one another.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned the religious makeup briefly there. Many people think that Arabs are just a big group of Muslims, but in fact, Arabs come from very diverse religious and non-religious backgrounds. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so the Arabic identity, or the Arab identity, is in many ways a cultural linguistic one. It's not a religious identity. The majority of the 400 million Arabs in the world are indeed Muslim. But in the United States, it's different. We don't know exactly, but Arab Americans are roughly half Christian, half Muslim in the United States. And in the state of Indiana, the majority of the early immigrants were for sure Christian, not Muslim. Mm-hmm. Until after really 1965, when the number of Muslim immigrants began to increase. Now, there were always Muslims here, but they were in Indiana. Again, they lived more around Michigan City than in Terre Haute and in Indianapolis. And the forms of Christianity that they practiced were oftentimes different than those in the United States. So, for example, I mean, some of them were Roman Catholic, but then here in Indianapolis, we're home to St. George Antiochian Orthodox Church. So this is a form of Eastern Orthodox Christianity, for example. My people, some of them were from the Melkite Church, and some of my people were also Muslim. And sometimes they married each other. That happened as mm-hmm. well.
So we mentioned a little bit at the top that it's National Arab American Heritage Month. I never knew there was a month, and maybe I'm going to be disowned. I'm half Arab, and I missed the memo on this one. But what does this month mean to you, and has it been around for a long time?
No, it has. The effort has been around. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and other Arab Americans have tried to get it passed through the Congress as a federal recognition. Instead, what we have are states with larger Arab American populations, Ohio, Michigan, they've all passed Arab American Heritage Month. And so you'll see it more in those places. We're not very organized as an Arab American community here in Indiana, and that makes us different than Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio. But I mean, what I love about this month is sort of connecting with not just my own ancestors, but the opportunity to learn about the richness of all the contributions of Arab Americans across the country, including in Indiana. I've been cooking more grape leaves this month, eating more hummus. it's a time to really remember the people who made my life possible, but also those who made your life and other Arab Americans' lives possible.
And so what's next with your documentary? I know you have like a bit of a trailer on your website. Is this going to be a longer piece at some point?
Yes, we're hoping. My team of Becky Fisher and Vinnie Manganello are looking for or working with local Arab American community members, and we're going together. We want to explore and unearth all of this buried history from Lucas Oil Stadium to the state capitol, and we're hoping to make an hour-long documentary. We're still in the pre-production phase. We're raising money for it, and writing grants, of course. But the script is written, and we're ready to. All the research is done, and we're ready to do the work.
All right. Well, we're definitely looking forward to checking that out. And, all the research that you've done so far was really refreshing and eye-opening for me just to check it out and learn more about Arab Americans in Indiana. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Edward Curtis. It's been a pleasure.
All right. It's great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Edward Curtis is the Plater Chair at IUPUI. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed the theme song. If you want to listen to this episode again or listen to one of our past programs, you can find All In anywhere you get your podcasts. Monday, we'll talk to an epidemiologist about the mask mandate being lifted, and we'll hear about proposed legislation that aims to strengthen current sexual assault laws. You can keep in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. Until next time, I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.